just hoping for a chance. On the south side of Chicago, people wanting to sell crack vastly outnumbered the available street corners. These budding drug lords bumped up against an immutable law of labor. When there are a lot of people willing and able to do a job, that job generally doesn't pay well. This is one of four meaningful factors that determine a wage. The others are the specialized skills a job requires, the unpleasantness of a job, and the demand for services that the job fulfills. The delicate balance between these factors helps explain why, for instance, the typical prostitute earns more than the typical architect. It may not seem as though she should. The architect would appear to be more skilled, as the word is usually defined, and better educated, again, as usually defined. But little girls don't grow up dreaming of becoming prostitutes, so the supply of potential prostitutes is relatively small. Their skills, while not necessarily specialized, are practiced in a very specialized context. The job is unpleasant and forbidding in at least two significant ways: the likelihood of violence and the lost opportunity of having a stable family life. As for demand, let's just say that an architect is more likely to hire a prostitute than vice versa. In the glamour professions, movies, sports, music, fashion, there's a different dynamic at play. Even in second-tier glamour industries like publishing, advertising, and media, swarms of bright young people throw themselves at grunt jobs that pay poorly and demand unstinting devotion. An editorial assistant earning $22,000 at a Manhattan publishing house, an unpaid high school quarterback, and a teenage crack dealer earning $3.30 an hour are all playing the same game, a game that is best viewed as a tournament. The rules of a tournament are straightforward. You must start at the bottom to have a shot at the top. Just as a major league shortstop probably played little league, and just as a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan probably started out as a lowly spear carrier, a drug lord typically began by selling drugs on a street corner. You must be willing to work long and hard at substandard wages. In order to advance in the tournament, you must prove yourself not merely above average, but spectacular. The way to distinguish yourself differs from profession to profession, of course. While JT certainly monitored his foot soldier's sales performance, it was their force of personality that really counted, more than it would for, say, a shortstop. And, finally, once you come to the sad realization that you will never make it to the top, you will quit the tournament. Some people hang on longer than others. Witness the graying actors who wait tables in New York. But generally, people get the message quite early. Most of JT's foot soldiers were unwilling to stay foot soldiers for long after they realized they weren't advancing, especially once the shooting started. After several relatively peaceful years, JT's gang got involved in a turf war with a neighboring gang. Drive-by shootings became a daily event. For a foot soldier, the gang's man on the street, this development was particularly dangerous. The nature of the business demanded that customers be able to find him easily and quickly. If he hid from the other gang, he couldn't sell his crack. Until the gang war, JT's foot soldiers had been willing to balance the risky, low-paying job with the reward of advancement. But as one foot soldier told Venkatesh, he now wanted to be compensated for the added risk. Would you stand around here when all this shit is going on? No, right? So if I gonna be asked to put my life on the line, then front me the cash, man. Pay me more, 'cause it ain't worth my time to be here when they're warring. JT hadn't wanted this war. For one thing, he was forced to pay his foot soldiers higher wages because of the added risk. Far worse, gang warfare was bad for business. If Burger King and McDonald's launch a price war to gain market share, they partly make up in volume what they lose in price. Nor is anyone getting shot. But with a gang war, sales plummet because customers are so scared of the violence that they won't come out in the open to buy their crack. In every way, war was expensive for JT. So why did he start the war? As a matter of fact, he didn't. It was his foot soldiers who started it. It turns out that a crack boss didn't have as much control over his subordinates as he would have liked. That's because they had different incentives. For JT, violence was a distraction from the business at hand. He would have preferred that his members never fired a single gunshot. For a foot soldier, however, violence served a purpose. One of the few ways that a foot soldier could distinguish himself and advance in the tournament was by proving his mettle for violence. A killer was respected, feared, talked about. A foot soldier's incentive was to make a name for himself. JT's incentive was, in effect, to keep the foot soldiers from doing so. "We try to tell these shorties that they belong to a serious organization," he once told Venkatesh. "It ain't all about killing. They see these movies and shit, they think it's all about running around tearing shit up. But it's not. You've got to learn to be part of an organization. You can't be fighting all the time. It's bad for business." In the end, JT prevailed. He oversaw the gang's expansion and ushered in a new era of prosperity and relative peace. JT was a winner. He was paid well because so few people could do what he did. He was a tall, good-looking, smart, tough man who knew how to motivate people. He was shrewd, too, never tempting arrest by carrying guns or cash. While the rest of his gang lived in poverty with their mothers, JT had several homes, several women, several cars. He also had his business education, of course. He constantly worked to extend this advantage. That was why he ordered the corporate-style bookkeeping that eventually found its way into Sudhir Venkatesh's hands. No other franchise leader had ever done such a thing. JT once showed his ledgers to the board of directors to prove, as if proof were needed, the extent of his business acumen. And it worked. After 6 years running his local gang, JT was promoted to the board of directors. He was now 34 years old. He had won the tournament. But this tournament had a catch that publishing and pro sports and even Hollywood don't have. Selling drugs, after all, is illegal. Not long after he made the board of directors, the Black Disciples were essentially shut down by a federal indictment. The same indictment that led the gangster named Booty to turn over his notebooks to Venkatesh. And JT was sent to prison. Chapter 4. Where Have All the Criminals Gone? In 1966, 1 year after Nicolae Ceaușescu became the communist dictator of Romania, he made abortion illegal. "The fetus is the property of the entire society," he proclaimed. "Anyone who avoids having children is a deserter who abandons the laws of national continuity." Such grandiose declarations were commonplace during Ceaușescu's reign, for his master plan to create a nation worthy of the new socialist man was an exercise in grandiosity. He built palaces for himself while alternately brutalizing and neglecting his citizens. Abandoning agriculture in favor of manufacturing, he forced many of the nation's rural dwellers into unheated apartment buildings. He gave government positions to 40 family members, including his wife, Elena, who required 40 homes and a commensurate supply of fur and jewels. Madame Ceaușescu, known officially as the best mother Romania could have, was not, in fact, particularly maternal. "The worms never get satisfied, regardless of how much food you give them," she said when Romanians complained about the food shortages brought on by her husband's mismanagement. She had her own children bugged to ensure their loyalty. Ceaușescu's ban on abortion was designed to achieve one of his major aims, to rapidly strengthen Romania by boosting its population. Until 1966, Romania had had one of the most liberal abortion policies in the world. Abortion was in fact the main form of birth control, with 4 abortions for every single live birth. Now, virtually overnight, abortion was forbidden. The only exemptions were mothers who already had 4 children or women with significant standing in the Communist Party. At the same time, all contraception and sex education were banned. Government agents, sardonically known as the menstrual police, regularly rounded up women in their workplaces to administer pregnancy tests. If a woman repeatedly failed to conceive, she was forced to pay a steep celibacy tax. Ceaușescu's incentives produced the desired effect. Within 1 year of the abortion ban, the Romanian birth rate had doubled. These babies were born into a country where, unless you belonged to the Ceausescu clan or the communist elite, life was miserable. But these children would turn out to have particularly miserable lives. Compared to Romanian children born just 1 year earlier, the cohort of children born after the abortion ban would do worse in every measurable way. They would test lower in school, they would have less success in the labor market, and they would also prove much more likely to become criminals. The abortion ban stayed in effect until Ceausescu finally lost his grip on Romania. On December 16, 1989, thousands of people took to the streets of Timișoara to protest his corrosive regime. Many of the protesters were teenagers and college students. The police killed dozens of them. One of the opposition leaders, a 41-year-old professor, later said that it was his 13-year-old daughter who insisted he attend the protest, despite his fear. "What is most interesting," he said, "is that we learned not to be afraid from our children. Most were aged 13 to 20. A few days after the massacre in Timișoara, Ceausescu gave a speech in Bucharest before 100,000 people. Again, the young people were out in force. They shouted down Ceausescu with cries of "Timișoara" and "Down with the murderers." His time had come. He and Elena tried to escape the country with $1 billion, but they were captured, given a crude trial, and, on Christmas Day, executed by firing squad. Of all the communist leaders deposed in the years bracketing the collapse of the Soviet Union, only Nicolae Ceausescu met a violent death. It should not be overlooked that his demise was precipitated in large measure by the youth of Romania, a great number of whom, were it not for his abortion ban, would never have been born at all. The story of abortion in Romania might seem an odd way to begin telling the story of American crime in the 1990s, but it's not. In one important way, the Romanian abortion story is a reverse image of the American crime story. The point of overlap was on that Christmas Day of 1989, when Nicolae Ceausescu learned the hard way, with a bullet to the head, that his abortion ban had much deeper implications than he knew. On that day, crime was just about at its peak in the United States. In the previous 15 years, violent crime had risen 80%. It was crime that led the nightly news and the national conversation. When the crime rate began falling in the early 1990s, it did so with such speed and suddenness that it surprised everyone. It took some experts many years to even recognize that crime was falling, so confident had they been of its continuing rise. Long after crime had peaked, in fact, some of them continued to predict ever darker scenarios. But the evidence was irrefutable. The long and brutal spike in crime was moving in the opposite direction, and it wouldn't stop until the crime rate had fallen back to the levels of 40 years earlier. Now the experts hustled to explain their faulty forecasting. The criminologist James Allen Fox explained that his warning of a bloodbath was in fact an intentional overstatement. "I never said there would be blood flowing in the streets," he said, "but I used strong terms like bloodbath to get people's attention, and it did. I don't apologize for using alarmist terms." If Fox seems to be offering a distinction without a difference, bloodbath versus blood flowing in the streets, we should remember that even in retreat mode, experts can be self-serving. After the relief had settled in, after people remembered how to go about their lives without the pressing fear of crime, there arose a natural question. Just where did all those criminals go? At one level, the answer seemed puzzling. After all, if none of the criminologists, police officials, economists, politicians, or others who traffic in such matters had foreseen the crime decline, how could they suddenly identify its causes? But this diverse army of experts now marched out a phalanx of hypotheses to explain the drop in crime. A great many newspaper articles would be written on the subject. Their conclusions often hinged on which expert had most recently spoken to which reporter. Here, ranked by frequency of mention, are the crime drop explanations cited in articles published from 1991 to 2001 in the 10 largest circulation papers in the LexisNexis database. Crime drop explanation number one, innovative policing strategies. Number of citations, 52. Explanation number two, increased reliance on prisons, 47 citations. Number three, changes in crack and other drug markets, 33 citations. Number four, aging of the population, 32 citations. Number five, tougher gun control laws, 32 citations. Number six, a strong economy, 28 citations. Number seven, increased number of police, 26 citations. And number eight, all other explanations, including increased use of capital punishment, concealed weapons laws, gun buybacks, and others, 34 citations. If you are the sort of person who likes guessing games, you may wish to spend the next few moments pondering which of these explanations seem to have merit and which don't. Hint: of the seven major explanations on the list, only three can be shown to have contributed to the drop in crime. The others are, for the most part, figments of someone's imagination, self-interest, or wishful thinking. Further hint: one of the greatest measurable causes of the crime drop does not appear on the list at all, for it didn't receive a single newspaper mention. Let's begin with a fairly uncontroversial one, the strong economy. The decline in crime that began in the early 1990s was accompanied by a blistering national economy and a significant drop in unemployment. It might seem to follow that the economy was a hammer that helped beat down crime. But a closer look at the data destroys this theory. It is true that a stronger job market may make certain crimes relatively less attractive, but that is only the case for crimes with a direct financial motivation, burglary, robbery, and auto theft, as opposed to violent crimes like homicide, assault, and rape. Moreover, studies have shown that an unemployment decline of 1 percentage point accounts for a 1% drop in nonviolent crime. During the 1990s, the unemployment rate fell by 2 percentage points. Nonviolent crime, meanwhile, fell by 40%. But an even bigger flaw in the strong economy theory concerns violent crime. Homicide fell at a greater rate during the 1990s than any other sort of crime, and a number of reliable studies have shown virtually no link between the economy and violent crime. This weak link is made even weaker by glancing back to a recent decade, the 1960s, when the economy went on a wild growth spurt, and so did violent crime. So, while a strong 1990s economy might have seemed, on the surface, a likely explanation for the drop in crime, it almost certainly didn't affect criminal behavior in any significant way. Unless, that is, the economy is construed in a broader sense, as a means to build and maintain hundreds of prisons. Let's now consider another crime drop explanation, increased reliance on prisons. It might help to start by flipping this crime question around. Instead of wondering what made crime fall, think about this. Why had it risen so dramatically in the first place? During the first half of the 20th century, the incidence of violent crime in the United States was, for the most part, fairly steady. But in the early 1960s, it began to climb. In retrospect, it's clear that one of the major factors pushing this trend was a more lenient justice system. Conviction rates declined during the 1960s, and criminals who were convicted served shorter sentences. This trend was driven in part by an expansion in the rights of people accused of crimes, a long overdue expansion, some would argue. Others would argue that the expansion went too far. At the same time, politicians were growing increasingly softer on crime, quote, for fear of sounding racist, as the economist Gary Becker has written, quote, since African Americans and Hispanics commit a disproportionate share of felonies. So, if you were the kind of person who might want to commit a crime, the incentives were lining up in your favor. A slimmer likelihood of being convicted, and, if convicted, a shorter prison term. Because criminals respond to incentives as readily as anyone, the result was a surge in crime. It took some time and a great deal of political turmoil, but these incentives were eventually curtailed. Criminals who would have previously been set free, for drug-related offenses and parole revocation in particular, were instead locked up. Between 1980 and 2000, there was a 15-fold increase in the number of people sent to prison on drug charges. Many other sentences, especially for violent crime, were lengthened. The total effect was dramatic. By 2000, more than 2 million people were in prison, roughly four times the number as of 1972. Fully half of that increase took place during the 1990s. The evidence linking increased punishment with lower crime rates is very strong. Harsh prison terms have been shown to act as both a deterrent for the would-be criminal on the street and a prophylactic for the would-be criminal who is already locked up. Logical as this may sound, some criminologists have fought the logic. A 1977 academic study called On Behalf of a Moratorium on Prison Construction noted that crime rates tend to be high when imprisonment rates are high, and concluded that crime would fall if imprisonment rates could only be lowered. Fortunately, jailers did not suddenly turn loose their wards and sit back waiting for crime to fall. As the political scientist John J. DiIulio Jr. later commented, apparently, it takes a PhD in criminology to doubt that keeping dangerous criminals incarcerated cuts crime. The moratorium argument rests on a fundamental confusion of correlation and causality. Consider a parallel argument. The mayor of a city sees that his citizens celebrate wildly when their team wins the World Series. He is intrigued by this correlation, but, like the moratorium author, fails to see the direction in which the correlation runs. So, the following year, the mayor decrees that his citizens start celebrating the World Series before the first pitch is thrown, an act that, in his confused mind, will ensure a victory. There are plenty of reasons to dislike the huge surge in the prison population. Not everyone is pleased that such a significant fraction of Americans, especially Black Americans, live behind bars. Nor does prison even begin to address the root causes of crime, which are diverse and complex. Lastly, prison is hardly a cheap solution. It costs about $25,000 a year to keep someone incarcerated. But if the goal here is to explain the drop in crime in the 1990s, imprisonment is certainly one of the key answers. It accounts for roughly one-third of the drop in crime. Another crime drop explanation is often cited in tandem with imprisonment, the increased use of capital punishment. The number of executions in the United States quadrupled between the 1980s and the 1990s, leading many people to conclude, in the context of a debate that has been going on for decades, that capital punishment helped drive down crime. Lost in this debate, however, are two important facts. First, given the rarity with which executions are carried out in this country and the long delays in doing so, no reasonable criminal should be deterred by the threat of execution. Even though capital punishment quadrupled within a decade, there were still only 478 executions in the entire United States during the 1990s. Any parent who has ever said to a recalcitrant child, "Okay, I'm going to count to 10 and this time I'm really going to punish you," knows the difference between deterrent and empty threat. New York State, for instance, has not, as of this recording, executed a single criminal since reinstituting its death penalty in 1995. Even among prisoners on death row, the annual execution rate is only 2%, compared with the 7% annual chance of dying faced by a member of the Black Gangster Disciple Nation crack gang. If life on death row is safer than life on the streets, it's hard to believe that the fear of execution is a driving force in a criminal's calculus. Like the $3 fine for late arriving parents at the Israeli daycare centers, the negative incentive of capital punishment simply isn't serious enough for a criminal to change his behavior. The second flaw in the capital punishment argument is even more obvious. Assume for a moment that the death penalty is a deterrent. How much crime does it actually deter? The economist Isaac Ehrlich, in an oft-cited 1975 paper, put forth an estimate that is generally considered optimistic. He said that executing one criminal translates into seven fewer homicides that the criminal might have committed. Now do the math. In 1991, there were 14 executions in the United States. In 2001, there were 66. According to Ehrlich's calculation, those 52 additional executions would have accounted for 364 fewer homicides in 2001. Not a small drop, to be sure, but less than 4% of the actual decrease in homicides that year. So, even in a death penalty advocate's best-case scenario, capital punishment could explain only 1/25 of the drop in homicides in the 1990s. And, because the death penalty is rarely given for crimes other than homicide, its deterrent effect cannot account for a speck of decline in other violent crimes. It is extremely unlikely, therefore, that the death penalty, as currently practiced in the United States, exerts any real influence on crime rates. Even many of its one-time supporters have come to this conclusion. I feel morally and intellectually obligated simply to concede that the death penalty experiment has failed, said U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry A. Blackmun in 1994, nearly 20 years after he had voted for its reinstatement. I no longer shall tinker with the machinery of death. So it wasn't capital punishment that drove crime down, nor was it the booming economy. But higher rates of imprisonment did have a lot to do with it. All those criminals didn't march into jail by themselves, of course. Someone had to investigate the crime, catch the bad guy, and put together the case that would get him convicted. Which naturally leads to a related pair of crime drop explanations. Innovative policing strategies and increased number of police. Let's address the second one first. The number of police officers per capita in the United States rose about 14% during the 1990s. Does merely increasing the number of police, however, reduce crime? The answer would seem obvious, yes, but proving that answer isn't so easy. That's because when crime is rising, people clamor for protection and invariably more money is found for cops. So, if you just look at raw correlations between police and crime, you will find that when there are more police, there tends to be more crime. That doesn't mean, of course, that the police are causing the crime, just as it doesn't mean, as some criminologists have argued, that crime will fall if criminals are released from prison. To show causality, we need a scenario in which more police are hired for reasons completely unrelated to rising crime. If, for instance, police were randomly sprinkled in some cities and not in others, we could look to see whether crime declines in the cities where the police happen to land. As it turns out, that exact scenario is often created by vote-hungry politicians. In the months leading up to Election Day, incumbent mayors routinely try to lock up the law and order vote by hiring more police, even when the crime rate is standing still. So, by comparing the crime rate in one set of cities that have recently had an election, and which therefore hired extra police, with another set of cities that had no election, and therefore no extra police, it's possible to tease out the effect of the extra police on crime. The answer? Yes, indeed, additional police substantially lower the crime rate. Again, it may help to look backward and see why crime had risen so much in the first place. From 1960 to 1985, the number of police officers fell more than 50% relative to the number of crimes. In some cases, hiring additional police was considered a violation of the era's liberal aesthetic. In others, it was simply considered too expensive. This 50% decline in police translated into a roughly equal decline in the probability that a given criminal would be caught. Coupled with the earlier mentioned leniency in the other half of the criminal justice system, the courtrooms, this decrease in policing created a strong positive incentive for criminals. By the 1990s, philosophies and necessities had changed. The policing trend was put in reverse with wide-scale hiring in cities across the country. Not only did all those police act as a deterrent, but they also provided the manpower to imprison criminals who might have otherwise gone uncaught. The hiring of additional police accounted for roughly 10% of the 1990s crime drop. But it wasn't only the number of police that changed in the 1990s. Consider the most commonly cited crime drop explanation of all, innovative policing strategies. There was perhaps no more attractive theory than the belief that smart policing stops crime. It offered a set of bona fide heroes rather than simply a dearth of villains. This theory rapidly became an article of faith because it appealed to the factors that, according to John Kenneth Galbraith, most contribute to the formation of conventional wisdom: the ease with which an idea may be understood and the degree to which it affects our personal well-being. The story played out most dramatically in New York City, where newly elected Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and his hand-picked police commissioner, William Bratton, vowed to fix the city's desperate crime situation. Bratton took a novel approach to policing. He ushered the NYPD into what one senior police official later called our Athenian period, in which new ideas were given weight over calcified practices. Instead of coddling his precinct commanders, Bratton demanded accountability. Instead of relying solely on old-fashioned cop know-how, he introduced technological solutions like CopStat, a computerized method of addressing crime hotspots. The most compelling new idea that Bratton brought to life stemmed from the broken window theory, which was conceived by the criminologists James Q. Wilson and George Kelling. The broken window theory argues that minor nuisances, if left unchecked, turn into major nuisances. That is, if someone breaks a window and sees it isn't fixed immediately, he gets the signal that it's all right to break the rest of the windows and maybe set the building on fire too. So, with murder raging all around, Bill Bratton's cops began to police the sort of deeds that used to go unpoliced: jumping a subway turnstile, panhandling too aggressively, urinating in the streets, swabbing a filthy squeegee across a car's windshield unless the driver made an appropriate donation. Most New Yorkers love this crackdown on its own merit, but they particularly love the idea, as stoutly preached by Bratton and Giuliani, that choking off these small crimes was like choking off the criminal element's oxygen supply. Today's turnstile jumper might easily be wanted for yesterday's murder. That junkie peeing in an alley might have been on his way to a robbery. As violent crime began to fall dramatically, New Yorkers were more than happy to heap laurels on their operatic, Brooklyn-bred mayor and his hatchet-faced police chief with the big Boston accent. But these two strong-willed men weren't very good at sharing the glory. Soon after the city's crime turnaround landed Bratton, and not Giuliani, on the cover of Time magazine, Bratton was pushed to resign. He had been police commissioner for just 27 months. New York City was a clear innovator in police strategies during the 1990s crime drop, and it also enjoyed the greatest decline in crime of any large American city. Homicide rates fell from 30.7 per 100,000 people in 1990 to just 8.4 per 100,000 people in 2000, a change of 72.6%. But a careful analysis of the facts shows that the innovative policing strategies probably had little effect on this huge decline. First, the drop in crime in New York actually began in 1990. By the end of 1993, the rate of property crime and violent crime, including homicides, had already fallen nearly 20%. Rudolph Giuliani, however, did not become mayor and install Bratton until early 1994. So crime was well on its way down before either man arrived. And it would continue to fall long after Bratton was bumped from office. Second, the new police strategies were accompanied by a much more significant change within the police force: a hiring binge. Between 1991 and 2001, the NYPD grew by 45%, more than three times the national average. As argued earlier, an increase in the number of police, regardless of new strategies, has been proven to reduce crime. By a conservative calculation, this huge expansion of New York's police force would be expected to reduce crime in New York by 18% relative to the national average. If you subtract that 18% from New York's homicide reduction, thereby discounting the effect of the police hiring surge, New York no longer leads the nation with its 73% drop. It goes straight to the middle of the pack. Many of those new police were in fact hired by David Dinkins, the mayor whom Giuliani defeated. Dinkins had been desperate to secure the law and order vote having known all along that his opponent would be Giuliani, a former federal prosecutor. The two men had actually run against each other 4 years earlier as well. So those who wish to credit Giuliani with the crime drop may still do so, for it was his own law and order reputation that made Dinkins hire all those police. In the end, of course, the police increase helped everyone, but it helped Giuliani a lot more than Dinkins. Most damaging to the claim that New York's police innovations radically lowered crime is one simple and often overlooked fact. Crime went down everywhere during the 1990s, not only in New York. Few other cities tried the kind of police strategies that New York did, and certainly none with the same zeal. But even in Los Angeles, a city notorious for bad policing, crime fell at about the same rate as it did in New York, once the growth in New York's police force is accounted for. It would be churlish to argue that smart policing isn't a good thing. Bill Bratton certainly deserves credit for invigorating New York's police force. But there is frighteningly little evidence that his strategy was the crime panacea that he and the media deemed it. The next step will be to continue measuring the impact of police innovations. In Los Angeles, for instance, where Bratton himself became police chief in late 2002. While he duly instituted some of the innovations that were his hallmark in New York, Bratton announced that his highest priority was a more basic one, finding the money to hire thousands of new police officers. Now to explore another pair of common crime drop explanations: tougher gun laws and changes in crack and other drug markets. First, the guns. Debates on this subject are rarely cool-headed. Gun advocates believe that gun laws are too strict. Opponents believe exactly the opposite. How can intelligent people view the world so differently? Well, it's because a gun raises a complex set of issues that change according to one factor: whose hand happens to be holding the gun. It might be worthwhile to take a step back and ask a rudimentary question. What is a gun? It's a tool that can be used to kill someone, of course, but more significantly, a gun is a great disruptor of the natural order. A gun scrambles the outcome of any dispute. Let's say that a tough guy and a not-so-tough guy exchange words in a bar, which leads to a fight. It's pretty obvious to the not-so-tough guy that he'll be beaten, so why bother fighting? The pecking order remains intact. But if the not-so-tough guy happens to have a gun, he stands a good chance of winning. In this scenario, the introduction of a gun may well lead to more violence. Now, instead of the tough guy and the not-so-tough guy, picture a high school girl out for a nighttime stroll when she's suddenly set upon by a mugger. What if only the mugger is armed? What if only the girl is armed? What if both are armed? A gun opponent might argue that the gun has to be kept out of the mugger's hands in the first place. A gun advocate might argue that the high school girl needs to have a gun to disrupt what has become the natural order. It's the bad guys that have the guns. If the girl scares off the mugger, then the introduction of a gun in this case may lead to less violence. Any mugger with even a little initiative is bound to be armed. For in a country like the United States, with a thriving black market in guns, anyone can get hold of one. There are enough guns in the United States that if you gave one to every adult, you'd run out of adults before you ran out of guns. Nearly two-thirds of U.S. homicides involve a gun, a far greater fraction than in other industrialized countries. Our homicide rate is also much higher than in those other countries. It would therefore seem likely that our homicide rate is so high in part because guns are so easily available. And research indeed shows this to be true. But guns are not the whole story. In Switzerland, every adult male is issued an assault rifle for militia duty and is allowed to keep the gun at home. On a per capita basis, Switzerland has more firearms than just about any other country, and yet it is one of the safest places in the world. In other words, guns do not cause crime. That said, the established U.S. methods of keeping guns away from the people who do cause crime are, at best, feeble. And since a gun, unlike a bag of cocaine or a car or a pair of pants, lasts pretty much forever, even turning off the spigot of new guns still leaves an ocean of available ones. So, Bearing all this in mind, let's consider a variety of recent gun initiatives to see the impact they may have had on crime in the 1990s. The most famous gun control law is the Brady Act, passed in 1993, which requires a criminal check and a waiting period before a person can purchase a handgun. This solution may have seemed appealing to politicians, but to an economist it doesn't make much sense. Why? Because regulation of a legal market is bound to fail when a healthy black market exists for the same product. With guns so cheap and so easy to get, the standard criminal has no incentive to fill out a firearms application at his local gun shop and then wait a week. The Brady Act, accordingly, has proven to be practically impotent in lowering crime. A study of imprisoned felons showed that even before the Brady Act, only about one-fifth of the criminals had bought their guns through a licensed dealer. Various local gun control laws have also failed. Washington, D.C. and Chicago both instituted handgun bans well before crime began to fall across the country in the 1990s, and yet those two cities were laggards, not leaders, in the national reduction in crime. One deterrent that has proven moderately effective is a stiff increase in prison time for anyone caught in possession of an illegal gun, but there's plenty of room for improvement. Not that this is likely, but if the death penalty were assessed to anyone carrying an illegal gun, and if the penalty were actually enforced, gun crimes would surely plunge. Another staple of 1990s crime fighting and of the evening news was the gun buyback. You remember the image, a menacing, glistening heap of firearms surrounded by the mayor, the police chief, the neighborhood activists. It made for a nice photo op, but that's about as meaningful as a gun buyback is. The guns that get turned in are generally heirlooms or junk. The payoff to the gun seller, usually $50 or $100, but in one California buyback, 3 free hours of psychotherapy, just isn't an adequate incentive for anyone who actually plans to use his gun. And the number of surrendered guns is no match for even the number of new guns simultaneously coming to market. Given the number of handguns in the United States and the number of homicides each year, the likelihood that a particular gun was used to kill someone that year is 1 in 10,000. The typical gun buyback program yields fewer than 1,000 guns, which translates into an expectation of less than one-tenth of one homicide per buyback. Not enough, that is, to make even a sliver of impact in the fall of crime. Then there is an opposite argument, that we need more guns on the street, but in the hands of the right people, like the high school girl earlier, instead of her mugger. The economist John R. Lott Jr. is the main champion of this idea. His calling card is the book More Guns, Less Crime, in which he argues that violent crime has decreased in areas where law-abiding citizens are allowed to carry concealed weapons. His theory might be surprising, but it is sensible. If a criminal thinks his potential victim may be armed, he may be deterred from committing the crime. Handgun opponents call Lott a pro-gun ideologue, and Lott let himself become a lightning rod for gun controversy. He exacerbated his trouble by creating a pseudonym, Mary Roche, to defend his theory in online debates. Roche, identifying herself as a former student of Lott's, praised her teacher's intellect, his even-handedness, his charisma. "I have to say that he was the best professor I ever had," Roche wrote. "You wouldn't know that he was a, quote, right-wing ideologue from the class. There were a group of us students who would try to take any class that he taught. Lott finally had to tell us that it was best for us to try to take classes from other professors more to be exposed to other ways of teaching graduate material." Then there was the troubling allegation that Lott actually invented some of the survey data that support his more guns, less crime theory. Regardless of whether the data were faked, Lott's admittedly intriguing hypothesis doesn't seem to be true. When other scholars have tried to replicate his results, they found that right-to-carry laws simply don't bring down crime. Consider the next crime drop explanation, the bursting of the crack bubble. Crack cocaine was such a potent, addictive drug that a hugely profitable market had been created practically overnight. True, it was only the leaders of the crack gangs who were getting rich, but that only made the street-level dealers all the more desperate to advance. Many of them were willing to kill their rivals to do so, whether the rival belonged to the same gang or a different one. There were also gun battles over valuable drug-selling corners. The typical crack murder involved one crack dealer shooting another, or two of them, or three, and not, contrary to conventional wisdom, some bug-eyed crackhead shooting a shopkeeper over a few dollars. The result was a huge increase in violent crime. One study found that more than 25% of the homicides in New York City in 1988 were crack-related. The violence associated with crack began to ebb in about 1991. This has led many people to think that crack itself went away. It didn't. Smoking crack remains much more popular today than most people realize. Nearly 5% of all arrests in the United States are still related to cocaine, as against 6% at crack's peak. Nor have emergency room visits for crack users diminished all that much. What did go away were the huge profits for selling crack. The price of cocaine had been falling for years, and it only got cheaper as crack grew more popular. Dealers began to underprice one another. Profits vanished. The crack bubble burst as dramatically as the NASDAQ bubble would eventually burst. Think of the first generation of crack dealers as the Microsoft millionaires. Think of the second generation as Pets.com. As veteran crack dealers were killed or sent to prison, younger dealers decided that the smaller profits didn't justify the risk. The tournament had lost its allure. It was no longer worth killing someone to steal their crack turf, and certainly not worth being killed. So the violence abated. From 1991 to 2001, the homicide rate among young black men who were disproportionately represented among crack dealers fell by 48% compared to 30% for older black men and older white men. Another minor contributor to the falling homicide rate is the fact that some crack dealers took to shooting their enemies in the buttocks rather than murdering them. This method of violent insult was considered more degrading and was obviously less severely punished than murder. All told, the crash of the crack market accounted for roughly 15% of the crime drop of the 1990s. A substantial factor, to be sure, though it should be noted that crack was responsible for far more than 15% of the crime increase of the 1980s. In other words, the net effect of crack is still being felt in the form of violent crime, to say nothing of the miseries the drug itself continues to cause. The final pair of crime drop explanations concern two demographic trends. The first one received many media citations, the aging of the population. Until crime fell so drastically, no one talked about this theory at all. In fact, the bloodbath school of criminology was touting exactly the opposite theory, that an increase in the teenage share of the population would produce a crop of super predators who would lay the nation low. "Just beyond the horizon, there lurks a cloud that the winds will soon bring over us," wrote James Q. Wilson in 1995. "The population will start getting younger again. Get ready." But overall, the teenage share of the population wasn't getting much bigger. Criminologists like Wilson and James Allen Fox had badly misread the demographic data. The real population growth in the 1990s was, in fact, among the elderly. While this may have been scary news in terms of Medicare and Social Security, the average American had little to fear from this growing horde of oldsters. It shouldn't be surprising to learn that elderly people are not very criminally intent. The average 65-year-old is about 1/50th as likely to be arrested as the average teenager. That is what makes this aging of the population theory of crime reduction so appealingly tidy. Since people mellow out as they get older, more older people must lead to less crime. But a thorough look at the data reveals that the graying of America did nothing to bring down crime in the 1990s. Demographic change is too slow and subtle a process. You don't graduate from teenage hoodlum to senior citizen in just a few years. to even begin to explain the suddenness of the crime decline. There was another demographic change, however, unforeseen and long gestating, that did drastically reduce crime in the 1990s. Think back for a moment to Romania in 1966. Suddenly, and without warning, Nicolae Ceaușescu declared abortion illegal. The children born in the wake of the abortion ban were much more likely to become criminals than children born earlier. Why was that? Studies in other parts of Eastern Europe and in Scandinavia from the 1930s through the 1960s reveal a similar trend. In most of these cases, abortion was not forbidden outright, but a woman had to receive permission from a judge in order to obtain one. Researchers found that in the instances where the woman was denied an abortion, she often resented her baby and failed to provide it with a good home. Even when controlling for the income, age, education, and health of the mother, the researchers found that these children, too, were more likely to become criminals. The United States, meanwhile, has had a different abortion history than Europe. In the early days of the nation, it was permissible to have an abortion prior to quickening, that is, when the first movements of the fetus could be felt, usually around the 16th to 18th week of pregnancy. In 1828, New York became the first state to restrict abortion. By 1990, it had been made illegal throughout the country. Abortion in the 20th century was often dangerous and usually expensive. Fewer poor women, therefore, had abortions. They also had less access to birth control. What they did have, accordingly, was a lot more babies. In the late 1960s, several states began to allow abortion under extreme circumstances, rape, incest, or danger to the mother. By 1970, five states had made abortion entirely legal and broadly available: New York, California, Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii. On January 22, 1973, legalized abortion was suddenly extended to the entire country with the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Roe v. Wade. The majority opinion, written by Justice Harry Blackmun, spoke specifically to the would-be mother's predicament. The detriment that the state would impose upon the pregnant woman by denying this choice altogether is apparent, he wrote. Maternity, or additional offspring, may force upon the woman a distressful life and future. Psychological harm may be imminent. Mental and physical health may be taxed by childcare. There is also the distress for all concerned associated with the unwanted child, and there is the problem of bringing a child into a family already unable, psychologically and otherwise, to care for it. The Supreme Court gave voice to what the mothers in Romania and Scandinavia and elsewhere had long known. When a woman does not want to have a child, she usually has good reason. She may be unmarried or in a bad marriage. She may consider herself too poor to raise a child. She may think her life is too unstable or unhappy, or she may think that her drinking or drug use will damage the baby's health. She may believe that she is too young or hasn't yet received enough education. She may want a child badly, but in a few years, not now. For any of 100 reasons, she may feel that she cannot provide a home environment that is conducive to raising a healthy and productive child. In the first year after Roe v. Wade, some 750,000 women had abortions in the United States, representing one abortion for every four live births. By 1980, the number of abortions reached 1.6 million, one for every 2.25 live births, and it leveled off there. In a country of 225 million people, 1.6 million abortions per year, one for every 140 Americans, may not have seemed so dramatic. In the first year after Nicolae Ceaușescu's death, when abortion was reinstated in Romania, there was one abortion for every 22 Romanians. But still, 1.6 million American women a year who got pregnant were suddenly not having those babies. Before Roe v. Wade, it was predominantly the daughters of middle or upper-class families who could arrange and afford a safe illegal abortion. Now, instead of an illegal procedure that might cost $500, any woman could easily obtain an abortion, often for less than $100. What sort of woman was most likely to take advantage of Roe v. Wade? Very often she was unmarried or in her teens or poor, and sometimes all three. What sort of future might her child have had? One study has shown that the typical child who went unborn in the earliest years of legalized abortion would have been 50% more likely than average to live in poverty. He would have also been 60% more likely to grow up with just one parent. These two factors, childhood poverty and a single-parent household, are among the strongest predictors that a child will have a criminal future. Growing up in a single-parent home roughly doubles a child's propensity to commit crime. So does having a teenage mother. Another study has shown that low maternal education is the single most powerful factor leading to criminality. In other words, the very factors that drove millions of American women to have an abortion also seem to predict that their children, had they been born, would have led unhappy and possibly criminal lives. To be sure, the legalization of abortion in the United States had myriad consequences. Infanticide fell dramatically. So did shotgun marriages, as well as the number of babies put up for adoption, which has led to the boom in the adoption of foreign babies. Conceptions rose by nearly 30%, but births actually fell by 6%, indicating that many women were using abortion as a method of birth control, a crude and drastic sort of insurance policy. Perhaps the most dramatic effect of legalized abortion, however, and one that would take years to reveal itself, was its impact on crime. In the early 1990s, just as the first cohort of children born after Roe v. Wade was hitting its late teens, the years during which most young men enter their criminal prime, the rate of crime began to fall. What this cohort was missing, of course, were the children who stood the greatest chance of becoming criminals. And the crime rate continued to fall as an entire generation came of age, minus the children whose mothers had not wanted to bring a child into the world. Legalized abortion led to less unwantedness. Unwantedness leads to high crime. Legalized abortion, therefore, led to less crime. This theory is bound to provoke a variety of reactions, ranging from disbelief to revulsion, and a variety of objections, ranging from the quotidian to the moral. The likeliest first objection is the most straightforward one. Is the theory true? Perhaps abortion and crime are merely correlated and not causal. It may be more comforting to believe what the newspapers say, that the drop in crime was due to brilliant policing and clever gun control and a surging economy. We have evolved with a tendency to link causality to things we can touch or feel, not to some distant or difficult phenomenon. We believe especially in near-term causes. A snake bites your friend. He screams with pain and he dies. The snake bite, you conclude, must have killed him. Most of the time, such a reckoning is correct. But when it comes to cause and effect, there is often a trap in such open and shut thinking. We smirk now when we think of ancient cultures that embraced faulty causes. The warriors who believed, for instance, that it was their raping of a virgin that brought them victory on the battlefield. But we too embrace faulty causes, usually at the urging of an expert proclaiming a truth in which he has a vested interest. How, then, can we tell if the abortion crime link is a case of causality rather than simple correlation? One way to test the effect of abortion on crime would be to measure crime data in the five states where abortion was made legal before the Supreme Court extended abortion rights to the rest of the country. In New York, California, Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii, a woman had been able to obtain a legal abortion for at least 2 years before Roe v. Wade. And indeed, those early legalizing states saw crime begin to fall earlier than the other 45 states and the District of Columbia. Between 1988 and 1994, violent crime in the early legalizing states fell 13% compared to the other states. Between 1994 and 1997, their murder rates fell 23% more than those of the other states. But what if those early legalizers simply got lucky? What else might we look for in the data to establish an abortion crime link? One factor to look for would be a correlation between each state's abortion rate and its crime rate. Sure enough, the states with the highest abortion rates in the 1970s experienced the greatest crime drops in the 1990s, while states with low abortion rates experienced smaller crime drops. This correlation exists even when controlling for a variety of other factors that influence crime: a state's level of incarceration, number of police, and its economic situation.